Chapter 14. Until It's Over. Charmosian. Betrayal.
I've lost count of the days, said Loken,
crouching by one of the makeshift battlements that looked over the smouldering ruins of the Coral City.
I don't think Istvad III has days and nights any more, replied Saul Tarvitz.
Loken looked into the steel-grey sky, a mantle of cloud kicked up by the catastrophic climate change forced on Istvan III by the sudden extinction of almost all life on its surface. A thin drizzle of ash rained, the remains of the firestorm swept up by dry, dead winds a continent away.
They're massing for another attack, said Tarvitz, indicating the tangle of twisted ash-wreathed rubble that had once been a vast mass of tenement blocks to the east of the palace.
Loken followed his gaze. He could just glimpse a flash of dirty white armor.
World-eaters.
Who else?
I don't know if Angron even knows another way to fight.
Tarvitz shrugged.
He probably does. He just likes his way better.
Tarvitz and Loken had first met on Murder, where the sons of Horus had fought alongside the Emperor's children against hideous, mega-arachnid aliens. Tarvitz had been a fine warrior, devoid of the grandstanding of his legion that had so antagonized Torgadon. Loken barely remembered the journey back through the Sirenhold, scrambling through shattered tombs and burning ruins. He remembered fighting through men he had once called brother towards the great gates of the Sirenhold, and he had not stopped until he had his first proper sight of the Precentor's palace and its magnificent rose-granite petals.
"They'll hit within the hour," said Tarvitz. "I'll move men over to the defences."
"It could be a feint,"
said Loken, vividly remembering the first days of the battle for the palace.
"Angron hits one side, Eidolon counterattacks."
His first sight of Tarvitz's warriors in battle had resembled a great game, with the Emperor's children as pieces masterfully arranged in feints and countercharges. A lesser man than Saul Tarvitz would have allowed his force to be picked apart by them, but the captain of the Emperor's children had somehow managed to weather 3 days of non-stop attacks.
"We'll be ready for it," said Tarvitz, looking down into the depths of the palace.
Loken and Tarvitz had climbed into the structure of a partially collapsed dome, one of the many sections of the Precentor's palace that had been ruined during the firestorm and fighting. Sheared sections of granite petals formed the cover behind which Loken and Tarvitz were sheltering, while in the rubble-choked dome below, hundreds of the survivors were manning the defences. Lunar wolves and Emperor's children manned barricades made of priceless sculptures and other artworks that had filled the chambers beneath the dome. Now these monumental sculptures of past rulers lay on their sides with Astartes crouched behind them.
"How much longer do you think we can hold?" asked Loken. "We'll stay until it's over," said Tarvitz. "You said so yourself. Every second we survive, the chance grows that the Emperor hears of this and sends the other legions to bring Horus to justice."
"If Garrow makes it," said Loken, "he could be dead already, or lost in the warp."
"Perhaps, but I have to hope that Nathaniel made it out," said Tarvitz. "Our job is to hold them off for as long as we can."
"That's what worries me. This probably all started when Angron slipped the leash, but the Warmaster could have just pulled his legions out and bombed this city into dust. He would have lost some of them, but even so, this planet should have been dead a long time ago."
Tarvitz smiled.
"Four Primarchs, Garvil. That's your answer. Four warriors not given to backing down. Who would be the first to leave? Angron? Mortarion? If Eidolon's leading the Emperor's children, then he's got a lot to prove alongside the Primarchs, and I have never known Horus show weakness, not when his brother Primarchs might see it."
"No," agreed Loken. "The Warmaster does not back down from a battle once he's committed."
"Then they'll have to kill us all," said Tarvitz.
"Yes, they will," said Loken grimly.
The vox beads in both their helmets chimed, and Torgadon's voice sounded.
"Garvey, Saul," said Torgadon, "I've got reports that the World-Eaters are massing. We can hear them chanting, so they'll be coming soon. I've reinforced the eastern barricades, but we need every man down here." "I'll pull my men back from the gallery dome,"
voxed Tarvitz.
"I'll send Garvil to join you."
"Where are you going?" asked Loken.
"I'm going to make sure the west and north are still covered, and to get some guns on the chapel, too," said Tarvitz,
pointing through the ruins of the dome to the strange organic shape of the War Singers' Chapel adjoining the palace complex. The survivors had instinctively avoided the chapel, and few of them had even seen inside it. Its very walls were redolent of the corruption that had consumed the soul of the Coral City.
"I'll take the chapel, and Lucius can take the ground level," continued Tarvitz, turning back to Loken. "I swear that sometimes I think Lucius is actually enjoying this."
"A little too much, if you ask me," replied Loken. "You need to keep an eye on him."
A familiar dull explosion sounded, and a tower of rubble and smoke burst from the Coral City's tortured cityscape to the north of the palace.
"Amazing," said Tarvitz, "that there are any Death Guard left alive over there."
"Death Guard are tough to kill," replied Loken,
heading for the makeshift ladder that led down to the remains of the gallery dome. Despite his words, he knew that it really was amazing. Mortarion, never one to do things with finesse, had simply landed one of his fleet's largest orbital landers on the edge of the western trenches and saturated the defences with turret fire while his Death Guard deployed. That had been the last anyone had heard of the Death Guard in the Coral City. Though from the haphazardly aimed artillery shells that landed daily in the traitors' camps, it was clear that some loyal Death Guard still resisted Mortarion's efforts to exterminate them.
"I only hope we live as long," said Tarvitz. "We're running low on supplies and ammunition. Soon we'll start running low on Astartes."
"As long as one is alive, Captain, we'll fight," promised Loken.
"Horus picked some unfortunate enemies in you and me. We'll make him regret ever taking us on." "Then we'll speak again after Angron's been sent scurrying," said Tarvitz.
"Until then."
Loken dropped down into the dome, leaving Tarvitz alone for a moment to look across the blasted city. How long had it been since he had been surrounded by anything other than the nightmarish place the Coral City had become? 2 months? 3? Ashen skies and smouldering ruins surrounded the palace for as far as the eye could see in all directions, the city resembling the kind of hell the Istvanians themselves might once have believed in. Tarvitz shook the thought from his mind.
"There are no hells, no gods, no eternal rewards or punishments," he told himself.
Lucius could hear the killing. He could read the sound of it as though it were written down before him like sheet music. He knew the difference between the war cries of a world-eater and those of a son of Horus, and the variance between the tonal quality of a volley of bolter fire launched to support an attack or to defend an obstacle. The chapel Saul had tasked him with defending was a strange place to be the site of the Great Crusade's last stand. Not so long ago, it had been the nerve center of an enemy regime, but now its makeshift defenses were the only thing holding off the far superior traitor forces.
"Sounds like a nasty one," said Brother Solothan of Squad Massacre,
hunched down by the sill of the chapel window.
"They might break through."
"Our friend Loken can handle them," sneered Lucius. "Angron wants to get some more kills. That's all he wants. Listen, can you hear that?" Solothan cocked his head as he listened. Astartes' hearing, like most of their senses, was finely honed. But Solothan didn't seem to recognize Lucius's point.
"Hear what, Captain?"
"Chain axes. But they're not cutting into ceramite or other chain blades. They're cutting into stone and steel. The world-eaters can't get to grips with the sons of Horus over there, so they're trying to hack through the barricades." Solothan nodded and said,
"Captain Tarvitz knows what he's doing. The world-eaters only know one way to fight. We can use that to our advantage."
Lucius frowned at Solothan's praise of Saul Tarvitz, aggrieved that his own contributions to the defences appeared to have been overlooked. Hadn't he killed Varda's Prowl? Hadn't he managed to get his men to safety when the virus bombs and the firestorm had hit? He turned his bitter expression away and stared through the chapel window across the plaza, still stained dark with charred ruins. Amazingly, the chapel window was still intact, although its panes had been distorted by the heat of the firestorm, bulging and discoloured with vein-like streaks that reminded Lucius of an enormous insectoid eye. The chapel itself was more bizarre inside than out, constructed from curved blocks of green stone in looming biological shapes that looked as though a cloud of noxious-looking fumes had suddenly petrified as it billowed upwards. The altar was a great spreading membrane of paler purple stone, like a complex internal organ opened up and pinned for study against the far wall. "The world-eaters aren't the ones you should be worried about, brother,"
continued Lucius idly. "It's us." "Us, Captain?"
"The Emperor's children," said Lucius. "You know how our legion fights. They're the dangerous ones out there."
Most of the surviving loyalist Emperor's children were holding the chapel. Tarvitz had taken a force to cover the nearest gate, but several squads were arrayed among the odd, organ-like protrusions on the floor below. Squad Nasike had only four members left, including Lucius himself, and they headed the assault element of the survivors' force, along with squads Quimondal and Raetherin. Tarvitz had deployed Sergeant Caethron on the roof of the chapel with his support squad, as well as the majority of the Emperor's children's remaining heavy weapons. Astartes from the tactical squads were at the chapel windows, or in cover further inside. The rest of Lucius's troops were stationed in cover outside the chapel, among the barricades of fallen stone slabs they had set up in the early days of the siege. 2,000 space marines, enough for an entire battle zone of the Great Crusade, were defending a single approach to the palace, with the War Singers' Chapel as the linchpin of their line. Movement caught Lucius's eye as he peered through the distorted window into the blackened buildings across from him. There. A glimpse of gold. He smiled, knowing full well how the Emperor's children fought.
"Contact," he announced to the rest of his force. "Third block west, second floor."
"On it," replied Sergeant Caethron, a no-nonsense weapons officer who treated war as a mathematical problem to be solved with angles and weight of fire. Lucius heard the squads moving on the roof, training weapons on the area he had indicated.
"West front, make ready," ordered Lucius.
Several of the tactical squads hurried into firing positions along Lucius's side of the chapel. The tension was delicious, and Lucius felt a surge of ecstatic sensation crawling along his veins as he heard the song of death building in his blood. A raw, toe-to-toe conflict meant opportunities to exercise perfection in war, but to make it truly memorable, it needed these moments of feverish anticipation when the full weight of potential death and glory surged around his body.
"Got them," called Caethron from the chapel roof. "Emperor's children. Major force over several floors. Armor, too. Land raiders and predators. Last cannon, to the fore. Heavy bolters, cover the open ground mid-range and overlap."
"Eidolon," said Lucius.
Lucius could see them now, hundreds of Astartes in the purple and gold of the legion he idolized, gathering in the dead eyes of ruined structures.
"They'll get the support into position first," said Lucius. "Then they'll use the land raiders to bring the troops in. Mid to close range, the infantry will move in. Hold your fire until then."
Tracks rumbled as the land raiders, resplendent with gilded eagle's wings and frescoes of war on their armor-plated sides, ground through the shattered ruins of the Coral City. Each was full of Emperor's children, the galaxy's elite, primed by Eidolon and Fulgrim to treat the men they had once called brothers as foes worthy only of extermination. To Eidolon, the survivors of the first wave were ignorant and mindless, deserving only death, but they had reckoned without Lucius. He licked his lips at the thought of once again facing the warriors of his legion, warriors worthy of the name, enemies he could respect, or earn the respect of. Lucius could practically see the enemy squads deploying with such confidence that they looked more like players in a complex parade ground move than soldiers at war. He could taste the moment when the battle would really begin. He wanted it right there and then, but he also knew how much more delicious the taste of battle was when the timing was perfect. Windows shattered as fire from the tanks ripped through the chapel, kicking up shards of marble and glass.
"Hold!" ordered Lucius.
Despite everything, his Astartes were still Emperor's children, and they would not break ranks like undisciplined world-eaters. He risked a glance through the splintered glass to see the land raiders churning up the marble of the plaza. Predator battle tanks followed them, acting as mobile gun platforms that blew great shuddering chunks from the chapel's battlements. Las cannon fire streaked back and forth, Caethron's men attempting to cripple the advancing vehicles and the land raiders' sponson-mounted weapons trying to pick off the Astartes on the roof. A predator tank slewed to a halt as its track was blown off, and another vehicle burst into multicolored flames. Purple armored bodies tumbled past the window. Corpses served as an appetizer to the great feast of death. Lucius drew his sword, feeling the music build inside him until he felt he could no longer contain it. The familiar hum of his sword's energy field became part of the rhythm, and he felt himself slipping into the duelist's dance,
the weaving stream of savagery he had perfected over centuries of killing. How many men were in the assault? Certainly a large chunk of Eidolon's command. Lucius had fewer men, but this battle was all about winning glory and spectacle. A tank round shot through a window and burst against the ceiling, showering them in fragments and smoke. Lucius saw streaks of bolter fire from the palace entrance. Tarvitz was drawing Eidolon in, and Eidolon had no choice but to dance to his tune. He heard a musical clang and saw the assault ramps of the land raiders slam open, and Lucius glimpsed the close-packed armored bodies within. "Go!" he yelled, and the jump packs of the assault units opened up behind him, catapulting the warriors into battle. Lucius followed in their wake, vaulting through the chapel window. Squad Nasike came after him, and the rest of his warriors followed in turn. Battle. The dance of war. Lucius knew that against an enemy like Eidolon, there would be no time for anything but the most intense applications of his martial perfection. His consciousness shifted, and everything was snapped into wondrous focus, every color becoming bright and dazzling, and every sound blaring and discordant along his nerves. The duelist's dance took him into the enemy, as battle erupted in all its perfectly marshaled chaos around him. Heavy fire streaked down from the roof, and land raiders twisted on their tracks to bring their guns to bear on the Emperor's children, charging from the chapel. The Space Marines outside the chapel charged at the same instant, and Eidolon's force was attacked from two sides at once. Lucius ducked blades and bolts, his sword lashing like a serpent's tongue. Eidolon's force reeled. Squad Quimondal battled ferociously with the enemy warriors emerging from the nearest land raider. He danced past them, savage joy kicking in his heart, and he rolled under a spray of bolter fire to come up and stab his blade through the abdomen of an enemy sergeant. Death was an end in itself, expressing Lucius's superiority through the lives he took, but he had a higher purpose. He knew what he had to do, and his strangely distorted senses sought out the glint of gold or the flutter of a banner, anything indicating the presence of one of Fulgrim's chosen. Then he saw it. Armor trimmed in black instead of gold, a helmet worked into a stern, grimacing skull. Chaplain Charmosian. The black-armored warrior stood proud of the top hatch of a land raider, directing the battle with sharp chops of his eagle-winged Crozius. Lucius grinned manically, setting off through the battle to face Charmosian and slay him in a fight worthy of the Legion's epics. "Charmosian!" he yelled, his voice sounding like the most vibrant music imaginable. "Keeper of the Will! I am Lucius, once your brother, now your nemesis!" Charmosian turned his skull helmet towards Lucius and said, "I know who you are!" The chaplain clambered from the hatch and stood on top of the land raider, daring Lucius to approach him. Charmosian was a battlefield leader, and to fulfill that role he needed the respect of the Legion, respect that could only be earned fighting from the front. He would be a worthy foe, but that wasn't why Lucius had sought him out. Lucius leapt onto the land raider's track mounting and charged up its glacis until he was face to face with Charmosian. Bolter fire flew in all directions, but it was irrelevant. This was the only battle in Lucius's mind.
"We taught you too much pride," said Charmosian, bringing his lethal Crozius around in a strike designed to crush Lucius's chest.
He brought his blade up to deflect the Crozius, and the dance entered a new and urgent phase. Charmosian was good, one of the Legion's best, but Lucius had spent many years training for a fight such as this. The chaplain's Crozius was too heavy to block full on, so the swordsman let it slide from his blade as Charmosian swung at him time and time again, frustrating him into putting more strength into his blows. A little longer, a few more moments, and Lucius would have his chance. He loved the way Charmosian hated him, feeling it as something bright and refreshing. Lucius could read the pattern of Charmosian's attacks and laughed as he saw the clumsy intent written over every blow. Charmosian wanted to kill Lucius with one almighty stroke, but his Crozius rose too far, held too long inert as the chaplain gathered his strength. Lucius lunged, his sword sweeping out in a high cut that slashed through the chaplain's upraised arms. The Crozius tumbled to the ground, and Charmosian roared in pain as his arms from the elbows down fell with it. The battle raged around the scene, and Lucius let the noise and spectacle of it fill his overstimulated senses. The battle was around him, and his victory was all that mattered.
"You know who I am," said Lucius.
Your last thought is of defeat.
Charmosian tried to speak, but before the words were out, Lucius spun his sword in a wide arc, and Charmosian's head was sliced neatly from his shoulders.
Crimson sprayed across the gold of the Land Raider's hull. Lucius caught the head as it spun through the air and held it high so the whole battlefield could see it. Around him, thousands of the Emperor's children fought to the death as Eidolon's force, hit from two sides, reeled against the palace defenses and fell back. Tarvitz led the counterstrike, and Eidolon's attack was melting away. He laughed as he saw Eidolon's command tank, a Land Raider festooned with victory banners, rise up over a knot of rubble as it retreated from the fighting. The Loyalists had won this battle, but Lucius found that he didn't care. He had won his own battle, and pulling Charmosian's head from the skull-faced helmet and throwing it aside, he knew he had what he needed to ensure that the Song of Death kept playing for him. The War Singer's Chapel was quiet. Hundreds of new bodies lay around it, purple and gold armor scorched and split, runnels of blood gathering between the stained marble tiles. In some places they lay alongside the blackened armor of the world-eaters who had died in the initial assaults on the Coral City. The palace entrance was heavily barricaded, and in the closest dome of the palace the few apothecaries in the Loyalist force were patching up their wounded. Tarvitz saw Lucius cleaning his sword, alternating between wiping the blade and using its tip to carve new scars on his face. A skull-faced helmet sat beside him.
"Is that really necessary?" asked Tarvitz.
Lucius looked up and said, "I want to remember killing Charmosian."
Tarvitz knew he should discipline the swordsman, reprimand him for practices that might be considered barbaric and tribal, but here, amid this betrayal and death, such concerns seemed ridiculously petty. He squatted on the ground next to Lucius, his limbs aching and his armor scarred and dented from the latest battle at the entrance to the palace.
"Fair enough," he said, jerking his thumb in the direction of the enemy. "I saw you kill him. It was a fine strike."
"Fine," said Lucius. "It was better than fine. It was art. You never were much for finesse, Saul, so I'm not surprised you didn't appreciate it."
Lucius smiled as he spoke, but Tarvitz saw a very real flash of annoyance cross the swordsman's features, a glimpse of hurt pride that he did not like the look of.
"Any more movement?"
he asked, changing the subject.
"No," said Lucius. "Eidolon won't come back before he's regrouped."
"Keep watching," ordered Tarvitz. "Eidolon could catch us unawares while our guard's down."
"He won't breach us," promised Lucius. "Not while I'm here."
"He doesn't have to," said Tarvitz, wanting to make sure Lucius understood the reality of their position. "Every time he attacks, we lose more warriors. If he strikes fast and pulls out, we'll be whittled down until we can't hold everywhere at once. The ambush from the temple cost him more than he'd like, but he still took too many of us down."
"We saw him off, though," said Lucius.
"Yes," agreed Tarvitz, "but it was a close-run thing, so I'll send a squad to help keep the watch."
"So you don't trust me to keep watch now, is that it?"
Tarvitz was surprised at the venom in Lucius's voice and said,
"No, that's not it at all. All I want is to make sure that you have enough warriors here to fend off another attack. Anyway, I need to attend to the western defences."
"Yes, off you go and lead the big fight. You're the hero," snapped Lucius.
"We will win this," said Tarvitz,
placing his hand on the swordsman's shoulder.
"Yes," said Lucius. "We will. One way or another."
Lucius watched Tarvitz go, feeling his anger at his assumption of command. Lucius had been the one earmarked for promotion and greatness, not Tarvitz. How could his own glorious accomplishments have been overshadowed by the plodding leadership of Saul Tarvitz? All the glories that he had earned in the crucible of combat were forgotten, and he felt his bitterness rise up in a choking wave in his gullet. He had felt a moment's guilt as he had formed his plan, but remembering Tarvitz's patronizing condescension, he felt that guilt vanish like snow in the sunshine. The temple was quiet, and Lucius checked to make sure that he was alone, moving to sit on one of the outcroppings of smooth grey-green stone, and lifting Charmosian's helmet. He peered into the blood-stained helmet until he saw the glint of silver, and then reached in and pulled out the small metallic scrap that was Charmosian's helmet communicator. Once again, he checked to see that he was alone before speaking into it.
"Commander Eidolon," he said, his frustration growing as he received no answer.
"Eidolon, this is Lucius," he said. "Charmosian is dead."
There was a brief crackle of static, and then...
"Lucius?"
He smiled as he recognized Eidolon's voice. As one of the senior officers among the Emperor's children, Charmosian had been in direct contact with Eidolon, and, as Lucius had hoped, the channel had still been open when the chaplain had died.
"Commander," said Lucius, his voice full of amusement, "it is good to hear your voice." "I have no interest in listening to your taunts, Lucius," snarled Eidolon. "You must know we will kill you all eventually."
"Indeed you will," agreed Lucius, "but it will take a very long time. A great many Emperor's children will die before the palace falls. Sons of Horus and world-eaters, too, and Terra knows how many of Mortarion's Death Guard have died already in the trenches. You will suffer for this, Eidolon. The War Master's whole force will suffer. By the time the other legions get here, he may have lost too many on Istvan III to win through."
"Keep telling yourself that, Lucius, if it makes it easier."
"No, Commander," he said. "You misunderstand me. I am saying that I wish to make a deal with you."
"A deal?"
asked Eidolon.
"What kind of deal?"
Lucius's scars tightened as he smiled.
"I will give you Tarvitz and the Precentor's Palace."